Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Round one for the Democrats. Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Bernie Sanders said he was sick of hearing about Hillary Clinton's emails, so the candidates found other points of difference. But the biggest contrast was between their relatively polite discussion of issues and the relentless political combat displayed recently by Republicans. Nobody had expected that kind of conflict, but last night's encounter drew a massive audience, giving three also-rans the chance to make themselves known. We'll look at some of the moments that are setting the stage for the party primaries and the general election beyond. Today's talking point, a star is not behaving the way it's supposed to. Will science fiction be made real? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warman Olney, back with To the Point. The biggest audience ever for a Democratic presidential debate tuned in last night to see Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and three other candidates try to define themselves and establish the agenda for the upcoming election. We'll hear highlights and predictions of what's to come. Today's talking point. For years, astronomers couldn't explain what they were seeing far out in the Milky Way galaxy. Now they're searching for possible signs of intelligent life. First, this news update. Hundreds of Israeli troops are on the streets of Jerusalem and in the West Bank today as stabbing assaults continue, including one on security forces. William Booth reports from Jerusalem for The Washington Post. Good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Warren.
This has been going on for a couple of weeks. Is this the biggest response so far by the Israelis?
Yes, this is a big deal in Israel right now. There are Israeli troops usually or always out in the West Bank and the occupied territories and along the Gaza fence and along in the Golan Heights. But to bring Israeli soldiers into the heart of cities is a clear sign of Israeli concern about this. The last time I think they put troops, this many troops, several hundreds, into the heart of cities, into Jerusalem, would probably have been during the Second Intifada or uprising in the early 2000s.
Tell us about the incidents today.
Well, there were several incidents. There were two violent attacks today, one at the Damascus Gate, which goes into into Jerusalem's old city. A young man with a camouflage clothes on was stopped and asked for an identification and stabbed, tried to stab a border police officer. The officer was not hurt, but as the Palestinian ran away, he was shot and killed. And then there was a second one just a few hours ago at Jerusalem's central bus station, which is a really busy rush hour time. And a 71-year-old lady there was stabbed by a Palestinian. The woman was wounded but not hurt. The bus driver quickly closed the bus door. The woman, the victim gets inside, and the perpetrator runs a short distance and then is shot by a special forces policeman.
So you've been out in Jerusalem today. What is the mood of the people there on the street?
Well, both Jewish Israelis and Palestinians are really on edge today. They don't want to venture into each other's neighborhoods. Jewish residents here fear that a Palestinian will pop out and stab them at a bus station or run into them with a vehicle as they did yesterday. And also Palestinians are on edge. A lot of the Palestinians who make up about one third of Jerusalem's population, work in West Jerusalem. And on the Jewish side, the more Jewish populated side of Jerusalem. And they work in restaurants and construction sites and hotels and other things. And they have to cross the city. And they feel like they could be lynched or they could be attacked by a mob. And so there's a lot of fear on both sides.
What about checkpoints?
Okay, so the checkpoint situation is this. The Israeli government is trying to announced a plan to close down or restrict movement from the Arab neighborhoods of East Jerusalem. And so today we saw Israeli forces beginning to arrange vehicles and move some blockade elements, some large cement blocks, and to set up like portals into these Palestinian villages that, of East Jerusalem. By late afternoon, early evening, they were still letting cars pass through these. They hadn't closed them down. They were checking some IDs and looking in some trunks of young Palestinian men, but they were letting most people pass. We passed through. If they shut those down and keep people from moving out of these neighborhoods, one of the concerns is this will become another hotspot in this conflict, that if Palestinians want to throw rocks or engage or clash with Israeli police or soldiers, this would be an ideal place to do it. They wouldn't have to commute to go fight with Israeli soldiers. And so, and these neighborhoods are very dense often and very, you know, the streets are very narrow. It's hard for two cars to pass. So these are bad places to have violent confrontations.
Are the tourist sites still open?
The tourist sites are still open, Warren, and amazingly, it's almost like the tourists have some cone of protection over them. You see them kind of like walking through the old city throughout this whole conflict of the last 2 weeks, going about their business, looking for the Church of the Holy Sepulchre or going to visit the Western Wall or whatever other sites they want to see. And they're ignored and haven't been targets of any kind of attack by either by anyone.
So they're moving around on those very, very narrow streets in the old city.
Very narrow streets. And also they're walking through, you know, places that are a conflict zone at this particular moment. There's not as many of them as there usually is. There's a lot less, you see, but they're still there. And so far the Palestinian attackers have gone after people who are obviously Jewish, like Jewish people who are like in ultra-Orthodox clothes, dressed in blacks, or Israeli soldiers or Israeli police. They haven't appeared to target any tourists at this point.
Okay. William Booth in Jerusalem for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for giving us a sense of what that city is like under very, very difficult circumstances. Good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime, Warren. Thank you.
In a moment, round one for the Democrats on To the Point.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Alney back with To the Point. For months, reports about the Democrats' chances of retaining the White House have centered on Hillary Clinton's personal emails while she was Secretary of State. During the party's first debate last night, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders had a surprise for political commentators, the audience at the Las Vegas casino, and Hillary Clinton.
Let me say something that may not be great politics, but I think the secretary is right. And that is that the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails.
Thank you. Me too.
You know?
Michael Scherer is Washington bureau chief for Time magazine. Hard not to laugh along with Hillary Clinton on that one. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
Was that a surprise to you?
You know, it fits very much with Bernie Sanders' entire approach to this election. He said from the beginning he is not interested in making this a personal attack fight with Hillary Clinton, even though she's clearly his biggest rival. And he said that he really wants to focus on the set of issues that him and his supporters are most interested in. And clearly the email thing has been a distraction from that. I think it was also probably smart politics for him in that he came off as very authentic and even truth-telling. I mean, he's talking to a Democratic electorate who is sick of hearing about the emails. I don't know if it's true that the American people writ large are sick of it, because clearly conservatives and Republicans are quite delighted by the email chatter. But no, I think it fit what Bernie is about.
On the other hand, of course, we have the situation with Kevin McCarthy, which seemed to have prevented him from becoming Speaker of the House, where he said that the hearings on the emails were in fact politically inspired.
Well, I think that the fact that the Benghazi investigation has political aims is not really a secret. What was surprising about what McCarthy said is he admitted it, which then allows Hillary Clinton and other Democrats to use it against the Republicans and is going to hurt the Republican case. And it's also worth saying that when it comes down to the emails, there are two sets of investigations going here, the clearly politically motivated one on Capitol Hill, but there's also investigations happening at the State Department and the intelligence community and at the Justice Department about the handling of these emails. They're much lower stakes, at least up till now, and not as flashy as the congressional ones, but there are other issues at play here.
Thank you for making clear that there's a distinction between the emails and the Bengali investigation. I conflated the two in the question I asked you. First, let's talk a bit about issues where they did disagree in very interesting ways, it seems to me. Bernie Sanders calls himself a socialist, always has only become a Democrat in order to get in to the primaries. He was asked about whether he really thinks of himself as a capitalist.
Do I consider myself part of the casino capitalist process by which so few have so much and so many have so little, by which Wall Street's greed and recklessness wreck this economy? No, I don't. I believe in a society where all people do well, not just a handful of billionaires.
Now, during his commentary, Mr. Sanders cited Denmark as a place that's doing things right. Here's the way Hillary Clinton responded.
What Senator Sanders is saying certainly makes sense in the terms of the inequality that we have. But we are not Denmark. I love Denmark. We are the United States of America, and it's our job to rein in the excesses of capitalism so that it doesn't run amok and doesn't cause the kind of inequities that we're seeing in our economic system. But we would be making a grave mistake to turn our backs on what built the greatest middle class in the history
Senator
of the
Sanders.
World.
Senator Sanders.
So, Michael Schurer with the Time magazine, back to you. Did they both make the kinds of points they wanted to make in that exchange? Did they differentiate themselves from one another sufficiently?
Yeah, I love that quote, I love Denmark. I never would have expected a presidential candidate to say it. But I think Hillary clearly comes out the winner of that exchange. You know, Bernie Sanders has always identified himself as what he calls a democratic socialist. This doesn't mean he's against capitalism. It just means he sees a much larger role for the government and the economy than probably most Americans do. I think this question, though, is tripping him up. He first answered it on one of the Sunday shows last weekend, and then again was asked it. And if you saw in his response, he answers about casino capitalism. That's not the question. It's whether you believe in a capitalist system. And it's not a question he's comfortable answering. And I think for Hillary Clinton, who already has her eyes on the general election, it was an opportune moment to distinguish herself from Sanders, both for Democrats, but also looking forward to the rest of the country when she's going to be running against the Republicans. She doesn't want to be associated with the word socialism in a general election, assuming she becomes the nominee.
One place, of course, where there's an extraordinary difference between Democrats and Republicans is gun control, and was Hillary Clinton's effort to make a difference between herself and Bernie Sanders on that issue. Here's how it began with Hillary Clinton. She was asked, is Bernie Sanders tough enough on guns?
Secretary Clinton, is Bernie Sanders tough enough on guns?
No. Not at all. I think that we have to look at the fact that we lose 90 people a day from gun violence. This has gone on too long, and it's time the entire country stood up against the NRA. The majority of our country supports background checks, and even the majority of gun owners do.
Bernie Sanders responded. He's a senator from a rural state. He said, what can I tell Secretary Clinton that all the shouting in the world is not going to do what I would hope all of us would want, and that is keep guns out of the hands of people who should not have these guns and end this horrible violence that we are seeing. Michael Schurer, once again, he's got Republicans to think about as well as Democrats.
Yeah, and Hillary Clinton is running for very much an urban party where guns are seen as a scourge right now. I think Sanders has a point in saying that practically, as a political matter in this country right now, you can't get major gun bills through Congress, that you want to think smaller and go for more moderate changes. It's also true that even though Sanders has a long record of being more vocal in his support of gun owners, he is for background checks. It's not as if he's fighting Hillary Clinton on that. I think it's just it's more a matter of tone, and it just has to do with where he's from.
Michael Shero, once again, the Washington bureau chief for Time magazine. Before we get to any more sound bites and to the other three candidates, let me introduce Linda Kew. She's a reporter with PolitiFact. That is an independent fact-checking journalism website. It's a division of the Tampa Bay Times. Linda Kew with PolitiFact, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Glad to be here, Warren.
Were there any howling errors of fact last night?
We didn't see that much actually last night, but we did see a couple of half-truths. Bernie Sanders made the claim that 51% of African-American youths are unemployed and 36% of Hispanic youths are unemployed. And his numbers are a little high. The actual figures are about 31.5% for African-American youth and 18.6% for Hispanic youth. But overall, the point remains unchallenged. Black and Hispanic youth have significantly worse job prospects than their white peers. The other one that we would note is Clinton's sort of flip-flop on the TPP. She said last night that she hoped TPP would be the gold standard, which is sort of a distortion of what she said before. In 2012, she said TPP sets the gold standard in trade agreements. So sort of revising history there, and we gave that a half-true.
And the TPP is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is the trade deal with all the nations of Asia, excepting, or many of them at least, and also on the other side of the Pacific, excluding China. So the flip-flop then was perhaps overstated, or her denial of the flip-flop, and Bernie Sanders made some mistakes from a statistical point, but nothing major, I take it.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Let me introduce Bill Scherer, a senior writer for the Campaign for America's Future. That's a progressive advocacy group. He's also a contributing editor to Politico magazine. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Did you see anything from either Clinton or Bernie Sanders that you think definitively will change the agenda for the Democratic primaries?
Change the agenda? No. I mean, I think there already is this huge focus on income inequality and how do we raise wages. And there's in the Democratic Party, there's a great support for what Obama did on the stimulus and saving the country from a global depression. And the job growth has obviously greatly improved since he came in, but that wage question has been flat. But you did see a very clear distinction between Hillary saying, I'm going to go at this problem in a pragmatic way, and Bernie saying, I'm going to go at this by building a movement to change the entire system. That's the big debate within the party right now. Probably Hillary got the upper hand in that exchange as people start putting their minds towards who's going to be the best general election candidate. But I imagine that discussion is going to keep going over the next few months.
Very interestingly, Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, made a contrast between the Democratic and Republican debates. It seems to me it's relevant to hear it at this point.
On this stage, you didn't hear anyone denigrate women. You didn't hear anyone make racist comments about new American immigrants. You didn't hear anyone speak ill of another American because of their religious belief.
So Bill Scherer with Politico and the Campaign for America's Future, does this give the Democrats an opportunity to contrast themselves with Republicans as somebody who, as you say, focus on whether we ought to govern pragmatically or develop a movement for change?
I think there's great happiness in the Democratic diaspora today because the debate that they're having, there are ideological differences. In fact, the ideological difference between Hillary and Bernie is probably wider than what you see between, say, you know, Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz. But the civility of the Democratic debate is far superior to the fractiousness you see on the Republican side. You're not seeing in the Democratic debates things being uttered that are going to be thrown back at them in a general election. That's what Martin O'Malley was getting at. You know, Mitt Romney had a huge problem in 2012 being compelled to say, "I'm for self-deportation," to try to appease the anti-immigrant right during that primary. And now you have Donald Trump saying anti-immigrant things. You have Ben Carson saying anti-Muslim things. There's a great happiness that a Democratic, the image of the party is more sellable to the general electorate based on the debates and what you're seeing on the Republican side.
So, Michael Scherer, let me go back to you with Time Magazine. Last night's debate, according to CNN, got an audience of roughly 15 million people. No other Democratic debate has ever gotten that many. But the Republican debate, the first one, got an audience of 24 million on Fox. Do you think that people, having seen the debate last night, seeing that it was civil, seeing that it was a debate about issues, are going to be less interested in the Democrats than they are in the Republicans?
Well, I think they're going to continue to be less interested in the Republican debates. 25 million is what the Republicans were getting, or 24 million. Democrats got 15. Although I would say that I think that 15 million figure surprised a lot of people today, and I think it shows a real appetite across the country for re-engaging with politics again after several years now of most of the country just being disgusted with everything that's happening, which actually bodes well for all of us. What Democrats lack is the showmanship that and the sort of circus atmosphere that can sometimes come into the Republican debates. There's no Donald Trump. Lincoln Chafee is no Donald Trump for the Democrats. So they're never going to be able to match those numbers in that way. But you know, the other interesting question here is, Republicans have scheduled more debates than Democrats. They've put their debates at times when more people will likely be watching them. And we'll just get a lot more exposure of their ideas to a lot more people by the time we get to a general election. So one of the things Democrats are struggling with now is, how do we get our message out during the next 4 or 5 months to the country that we also have plans for the country? Because there are also a lot of very impressive Republicans on the debate stage who could appeal to a lot of moderates. And I think there are a lot of Democrats breathing a sigh of relief today that they got 15 million last night.
Let me introduce John Nichols. He's writer for The Nation. His latest book is Dollarocracy. John Nichols, good to have you back on our program.
It's great to be with you, Warren, and with your other great guests.
Do you think that the Democrats ought to have more debates? Should Hillary Clinton be shaking the lapels of the chair of the Democratic Party and saying, come on, let's do this some more?
Well, I don't know that Hillary Clinton will necessarily shake the lapels, although I think she had a very good night last night, so it might encourage her. But there is no question that Martin O'Malley, who has been literally, you know, yelling from the mountaintops for more debates, is right. So is Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, who's been in a very open dispute with the Democratic National Committee on this issue. The Democrats, I think, began to plot their debate strategy, their debate arrangements, at a time when they really did feel that it was going to be a very easy race for Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders has made that race more difficult. It isn't necessarily saying that Sanders is going to be the nominee, but it is saying that it's a much more intense race, as you saw from last night. And so I think it would be exceptionally wise of the Democrats to dramatically extend their debate schedule, at least go to as many debates as the Republicans, and take those debates to places they aren't going to at this point. I hate this notion of debates in primary and caucus states. You know, these are going to be nominees of both parties for the whole country. And so the Democrats really ought to be going to places like Ohio and, dare I say it, even California.
California, with a very late primary election, often has been out of the running when it comes to actually deciding who the nominees are going to be. We don't have a vote here until June. We're going to take a very brief break. Michael Scherer with Time Magazine, thanks a lot for being with us. We'll be back and continue this conversation with our other guests later on today's Talking Point: unexplained light sources in outer space. Are they evidence of intelligent life? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, once again talking about last night's Democratic debate for among the candidates for the presidential nomination of their party. One person who we haven't heard from as yet is the former governor and former senator of Rhode Island, Lincoln Chafee. He brought up as a issue of Hillary Clinton's suitability for the presidency, her vote for the Iraq war. She was, of course, in favor of it. And here's what Chafee had to say.
If you're looking ahead and you're looking at someone that made that poor decision in 2002 to go into Iraq when there was no real evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, I know because I did my homework. And so that's an indication of how someone will perform in the future. And that's what's important.
And Hillary Clinton, of course, then got a chance to respond.
I recall very well being on a debate stage, I think about 25 times, with then Senator Obama debating this very issue. After the election, he asked me to become Secretary of State. He valued my judgment, and I spent a lot of time with him in the Situation Room going over some very difficult issues.
John Nichols with The Nation. What about the exchange we just heard? And will she, do you think, have to answer for her vote again and again as the Democratic primaries go on?
I think that exchange is a perfect clip because Lincoln Chafee raised the issue completely appropriately. I mean, he was there. And I think, frankly, from my own view, I think he's got a good point. He did look at the facts. He was clear that it was not necessary to go to war. However, Hillary Clinton's response was, you know, whether you like her or not, stellar. What do you say beyond that the guy who may well have beaten her in large part because of the Iraq war issue hired her to be Secretary of State and worked with her for, you know, better part of 4 years, more than 4 years. Bottom line there is that in politics, we adjudicate certain issues. We bring them to the bar, we discuss and debate them, and then usually we finish with them. I think it's fair to say that except for a portion of people who are very anti-war and are really looking forward rather than backward, the issue is not going to be harmful to Hillary Clinton. Although I do think, I think that, if I can add one final thing, Lincoln Chafee's presence in the debate in this regard is a very positive thing because on a host of issues, Lincoln Chafee staked out a very fascinating internationalist, pretty much anti-war, pro-diplomacy stance, which you also saw in the question of intelligence gathering and whether to invite Edward Snowden back to the United States to welcome him back. So Chafee, even though he's pretty much a zero in the polls, I think brought some interesting elements to the debate.
Lincoln Chafee, formerly a Republican, only recently or relatively recently a Democrat, and he did get into some trouble with regard to his vote on repealing the Glass-Steagall Act. That is the Depression-era law that separated forms of banking. It was repealed largely because of Bill Clinton, who's now said that it was a terrible idea to do that and maybe it helped to lead to the financial collapse in 2008. And that was the first vote that Lincoln Chafee cast when he got to the Senate, as he explained when he was asked about it.
The Glass-Steagall was my very first vote. I just arrived. My dad had died in office. I was appointed to the office. It was my very first vote.
Are you saying you didn't know what you were voting for?
I just arrived the Senate. I think we'd get some takeovers. And that was one of my very first vote.
Anderson Cooper of CNN there breaking in. Bill Scherr, back to you. Did that do that answer and the trouble that he seemed to have with the answer cause him more trouble than he needed, given that nobody had seen much of him up until now?
Well, certainly, if you're a candidate around zero, you want these debates to be your breakout moment, and that to kill any chance of him having a breakout moment. As John said, he might be able to introduce some ideas into the debate that might not come up if he wasn't there, but that was going to help him get out of zero. But the Glass-Steagall issue is a live one for Hillary to grapple with. If I can just correct you slightly, what Bill Clinton has said and Hillary has said is that Glass-Steagall was not the problem for the collapse. It was a separate bill about derivatives deregulation that Clinton had, that Bill Clinton has said was wrong.
Thank you.
And Hillary has been saying it's really not about the big banks, because it's smaller institutions like Lehman that caused the problem, and therefore Glass-Steagall is sort of, you know, picking at the wrong target. And Bernie and Martin O'Malley and Lincoln Chafee at other points, you know, want to squeeze Hillary on that question. But Martin O'Malley tried a little bit last night, but no one has really taken the wood to Hillary on the Glass-Steagall question yet. But Hillary does seem to be prepared for it when it comes, because she has a sort of nuanced, wonky response to the whole matter.
Back to John Nichols with The Nation. Again, his latest book is Dollarocracy. Is this something, do you think, that will come up again?
Absolutely. In fact, you were talking in the earlier segment, which I thought was excellent, about some of the exchanges between Sanders and Clinton, and this question of whether this debate showed us anything new, illustrated something that might have some influence on the campaign as it goes forward. And I would argue that what this debate began to set in place, and I think you will hear more and more of, is a sharp critique of Wall Street. I think maybe the line of the debate was Bernie Sanders saying Congress doesn't regulate Wall Street, Wall Street regulates Congress. And Hillary Clinton has, with her recent stances on banking reform, come a good bit of the way toward a sharper critique. I think that is going to become more and more a part of the Democratic debate, because in many senses they can't simply repeat their basic lines, you know, four or five times, right, as go debate after debate. You've got to kind of burrow in deeper. And when you burrow in deeper to these financial issues, when you get into the real question of how you're going to make a functional economy in the United States, you've got to get to these subjects. I think Anderson Cooper was right to raise it. I only wish that last night he had pressed the point a little more.
Let me go back to Linda Kuh, once again, reporter with the PolitiFact, independent fact-checking journalism website and a division of the Tampa Bay Times. Often in this context, people run afoul of campaign contributions that they have received from various interests that they really don't want to be identified with. That didn't come up last night. But is that something where Hillary Clinton in particular is vulnerable, because she has, in fact, raised a lot of money from Wall Street and from other big special interests?
Absolutely. A few months ago, we fact-checked a viral meme that compared Bernie Sanders' major donors to Hillary Clinton's, and we found that it's mostly true that Clinton's major donors are corporations, media elites, while Sanders' major donors are unions. And last night, Sanders had this line that said, you know what, I'm not a billionaire, I don't take super PAC money, and I'm the only candidate who can say those things and also has raised a substantial sum of money. And that's pretty true. Trump obviously is the only candidate who's a billionaire and self-financed, but Sanders is one of four candidates who doesn't take super PAC money. And the other three, Webb, O'Malley, and Trump, haven't raised substantial amounts of money like Sanders. So he certainly has a unique position in this race when it comes to donations and campaign finance.
What about time on the air, Linda Kuh? Did one candidate or another get less?
That's not something that we really looked at. To be honest, we largely focused on Sanders and Clinton as the main candidates here. Our fact checks don't really look into time spent on air.
I think everybody else did exactly the same thing, and that was noticed by, among others, Jim Webb, who, of course, was the Secretary of the Navy during the Reagan administration, then became a Democrat and served a term as a senator from Virginia. He was trying to make some issues over foreign policy, and very particularly with China, and found himself being interrupted by Anderson Cooper.
We need to do this because of their aggression in the region. We need to do it because of the way they treat their own people. And I would say this. I've been waiting for 10 minutes. I will say this.
You're over your time, though.
You've let a lot of people go over their time. I would say this.
You agreed to these debate
rules. To the unelected, authoritarian government of China, you do not own the South China Sea.
Let me go back to Bill Scherer, the senior writer for Campaign for America's Future and a contributing editor to Politico magazine. Was the former Secretary of the Navy and Senator from Virginia fairly treated?
Well, Well, you know, in one sense, no, he didn't get equal time. But that is, you know, par for the course in these debates where the moderators, you know, give more time to the folks who are higher in the polls. If you're in the bottom tier, the burden is on you to grab the mic, to make waves, to say things that grab people's attention, to set the course of the debate. You can't expect it to be handed to you. I mean, maybe that's not fair, but the presidential races are not fair. The fairness is not what dictates who becomes the winner or not. People have to make their moments. And when you whine about it, as Jim Webb did, you don't get that breakout moment. You get looked down upon. So if he's invited to the next debate, I don't know what the poll thresholds are going to be. Both him and O'Malley and Chafee, they got to think to themselves, what can I do? I mean, Colly Fiorina at one point was not even invited to the main stage, but she had a good undercard debate. Her poll numbers went up. She got invited to the next one. She made a dent. That's what you have to do when you're in the bottom tier. Make your own moments.
What about Webb, though, and his potential appeal to what we used to call the Reagan Democrats, some of the people who began to move from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party because of Ronald Reagan? Are they still around?
Well, not by a lot. I mean, I don't think they, by any stretch, are a dominant factor in the Democratic primary. However, they do exist. There are conservative Democrats, particularly in red states. You know, there's an anti-abortion Democrat who might become governor of Louisiana this year. So the primaries go through all 50 states. These people are registered Democrats, and they still vote. They might not know that a guy like Jim Webb was even in this race. And so just on the mere fact that he existed and he was seen, you know, maybe he might go from 0 to 5% and get a little bit of a bump out of this and get some news coverage out of this. And even if that doesn't mean he becomes a serious contender for the primary, if he can show that that constituency is still around, you might get some movement or him running third party and thinking, can I tap this in a general election?
Linda Q, back to you with PolitiFact at the Tampa Bay Times. Can you, sort of in a general way, tell us how the Democrats compared to the Republicans in terms of what you do, which is check the facts? You indicated that there weren't really any terrible departures from reality on the part of the Democrats last night. What about the Republicans?
Well, first, let's just say that PolitiFact, the way that we choose claims is we base it off of newsworthiness and what we think readers are interested in.
Sure.
So it's not a scientific method. But overall, we did see that yesterday. The mistakes that were made were not glaring, and most of the claims that we rated came out to be mostly true or true. So that's a certain departure from the first and second Republican debates where we saw a lot of pants on fires and mostly falses. So I think there's definitely a divide between the two parties in terms of what they're saying out there. But again, that also might be the way that we pick facts. Although we didn't hear anything outrageous yesterday, otherwise we would have fact-checked it.
A couple of interesting categories that you mentioned there. False is one of them. Pants on fire mm-hmm. is the other one. What do you have to say to be categorized as having your pants on fire?
One of the most recent ones we had was Ben Carson saying that there was like a bad guys club between the Ayatollah and a couple of other bad guys in the news right now. So that was the pants on fire. And one of the ones that had to do with Hillary Clinton, I guess, that stood out for me was Dinesh D'Souza saying that there was a picture of Hillary Clinton floating around that showed her with the Confederate flag in the background. And that was just a obvious fabricated photo. So pants on fire there.
So at the moment, then, the Democrats are doing a bit better than the Republicans with regard to falses and pants on fire. You didn't really find any
right.
of a significant nature last night.
Right.
John Nichols, back to you. Do you think that Bernie Sanders, who I think you think so well of I think repeats a lot of the things, or not the repeats, but has some of the same sentiments that you do in your book, Dollarocracy, does he really have a chance to win?
Sure. You know, look, in presidential politics, the dynamic is you claim your chance to win. You know, obviously, we always have candidates who start a race as the clear front runner. Jeb Bush, to give you an example. There are now some people who think there's a chance Jeb Bush may not be the Republican nominee. And so the race can shuffle as it goes on. For Bernie Sanders, the chance to win is obviously defined as this thing progresses. What I would suggest to you also is that perhaps for an insurgent candidate like Sanders is an insurgent, there are many different definitions of win. One is to, you know, become the nominee, become president of the United States. Of course, you know, as we cover politics, we talk about it that way. But another definition is to shape the debate, to really kind of move things in a direction. By that second measure, and obviously, you know, that is a lesser measure, but by that second measure, I would think that last night's debate was something of a win for Sanders, because you had all the candidates, and certainly Hillary Clinton included in this, talking very seriously about economic inequality, about wage stagnation. When the issue of democratic socialism versus capitalism came up, that clip you played very early in the show, Hillary Clinton did not respond with some rant about what a horrible guy Bernie Sanders was or how profoundly out of touch he was or something like that. She talked about inequalities and inequities and about a necessity to intervene so that capitalism doesn't run amok.
So, Bill Scheer, back to you. I'm sorry to interrupt you, John, but we are running short of time. Do you agree that Bernie Sanders has been shaping the campaign, and does the debate of last night illustrate that?
Yeah, I'm a little more skeptical about that. I think a lot of there's definitely a shift left in the party, but a lot of that was predating Bernie's entry in the race. A lot of that was coming from, one, just the general aftermath of the crash and people being more comfortable with the idea of government regulation and government intervention. But the threat of Elizabeth Warren was pushing Hillary leftward in certain areas. And there's an argument that maybe the threat is more impactful than the actuality of the primary race. If you're at a point where you're running the primary and you're not winning, does that pressure tend to ease off? You know, Hillary, in one sense, has had to close the daylight with Bernie on TPP, the trade agreement, and Keystone, but in other areas where she's been very comfortable to distance herself from Bernie on the questions of movement politics versus pragmatic politics. So I think it remains to be seen what Bernie's actual impact on the trajectory of the debate will be. I don't know, I went based on this one debate alone.
All right, we're going to have to leave it at that. Let us all remember that this is just the beginning for the Democrats. They have more debates to come, although maybe not enough. We'll see if they, in fact, add some more. Good to have you all. Bill Scheer, once again, with the Campaign for America's Future and contributing editor to Politico Magazine. John Nichols with The Nation, his latest book, Dollarocracy. Linda Kuh with PolitiFact at the Tampa Bay Times. And our earlier guest, Michael Scherer, the Washington Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. Great to have you all. Is there intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? That's an ancient question, of course, but it's always worth asking. Now there is more evidence to make it worth asking again. Back in a moment with that on today's Talking Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Warren Alney here with today's Talking Point. For some years now, astronomers have been studying something in the Milky Way that seems to have no natural explanation. For what that means and for some background, here is Jason Wright. He's a professor at Penn State University, and his primary research is in extrasolar planets and sun-like stars. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What is this? Or how would you describe this thing that nobody seems to know how to explain?
Well, it seems to be a pretty ordinary star, a little hotter than the sun, and a group of citizen scientists that have been combing through the Kepler data. The Kepler spacecraft has been staring at a lot of stars for many years. These citizen scientists called planet hunters have been looking for stars like this that periodically get a little bit dimmer as planets pass in front of them as part of the planet hunting project. And they noticed this one was doing something really bizarre, and they contacted the head of the planet hunters group, Dr. Tabby Boyajian, about it, and she agreed that this was very hard to explain. Over the course of days, the star would very slowly and smoothly just get dimmer and dimmer until it had lost about 20% of its light and then suddenly get brighter again, as if some enormous object about the size of a star had been slowly passing in front of it, blocking the light and then passing out. And this sort of thing was happening over and over again, not periodically, just sort of randomly, over the course of Kepler's 4-year mission.
So why don't we believe it's a planet?
Well, it's blocking far too much light to be a planet. Even the largest planets would only block about 1% of the star's light, and this was blocking 1 to 5 to 20% of the star's light, and it was happening much too slowly over many days instead of over many hours. It's really inexplicable.
So it's inexplicable. Where do you turn then?
So Dr. Boyajian approached me at one point and asked if I had any ideas, and we batted around many ideas. There are things that have been seen sort of like this, disks around stars, planets with enormous ring systems, but they're almost always around very young stars, and this doesn't seem to be a young star. So we were kind of stumped. I told her I had one crazy idea, which is that astronomers for many years have thought that perhaps advanced alien civilizations would build enormous structures, megastructures, the sizes of planets and stars, perhaps to collect starlight or as giant telescopes or who knows what. But if that's true, that they would pass in front of stars a lot like this, and that the Kepler telescope would be able to see them if they were there. And I told her about that prediction and got thinking about it myself and decided that we maybe should be pointing radio telescopes at that star just in case that's what was going on.
All right, you're an astronomer. Here you are talking about alien civilizations.
Well, you know, you've got to keep an open mind, and it's certainly possible they're out there. And when you have something that's so hard to explain naturally, it's the kind of thing that, you know, you might want to think about tossing over to the SETI folks. I should emphasize, Dr. Boyajian and her colleagues did come up with a what I think is rather contrived explanation of a giant swarm of comets.
Okay.
And might, maybe.
Okay, so everybody's doing their best to figure out what this is. You mentioned
exactly.
SETI. SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. It is located at UC Berkeley, and Andrew Simeon is, in fact, the director there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, to pick it up where Professor Wright left off, what do you think?
Well, it's certainly incredibly exciting. When Tabby and Professor Wright contacted me, I was initially a bit skeptical, not having a lot of experience with or near as much experience as Professor Wright and Tabby had with these types of data. I thought that it must be some artifact or some error in the data analysis, but they assured me that that was not the case, and they convinced me actually quite quickly that wasn't the case. And I agree with Professor Wright. It is incredibly perplexing. And although it's a remote possibility that this signal that's seen is due to some advanced civilization around that star, it's certainly worth looking at. And I would certainly characterize it as the most interesting candidate that has thus come out of the Kepler mission from a SETI perspective.
So what do you pick it up with then? If the Kepler mission has only provided you with a mystery, what do you use next in order to try to get better information?
Well, that's exactly right. The Kepler mission is not itself a SETI experiment. It is not sort of directly intended to look for evidence of advanced technology. So this really represents sort of a candidate, just something interesting that we want to follow up. So we follow it up with what are kind of the traditional SETI techniques. And those are to look for electromagnetic radiation that could only come from technology as far as we know. So this is either radio signals or optical light that exhibits an amount of compression in frequency or in time. So that the energy is sort of scrunched up at just one sort of point on the radio dial or just one part of the optical spectrum. And as far as we know, those types of signals can only be produced by technology. So that's what we look for, to try to see if there might be an advanced civilization around that star.
If you can't look for it with the Kepler Space Telescope, are there other devices that you have available, or is that the main one?
Yeah, that's correct. So the Kepler Telescope is actually no longer looking at the part of the sky where this star was discovered. So we use telescopes that are on the surface of the Earth to follow up on it. So again, these are radio telescopes and optical telescopes, and these could include telescopes like the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia, the Very Large Array in New Mexico, or perhaps a low-frequency telescope that we're interested in the Netherlands.
Can you learn what you need to know from algorithms and from the study of computer data and that sort of thing, or does it require human judgment?
Well, that's a very good question. So we receive so much data from a modern telescope that we have to have algorithms that are sensitive to the kinds of signals that we're looking for. So we have to look at the data in an automated fashion just because there's so much of it.
But ultimately, you know, any sort of SETI experiment, and indeed any kind of astronomy experiment, ultimately is sort of a whittling down process. And we always take the human eye to the sort of top candidate in our list. And that's certainly what we'll do with this target.
The various telescopes that you mentioned all have schedules. There are a lot of people who want to use them. Do you have to make appointments in advance? Do you have to set up a program in order to be able to look? And is this situation sufficiently pressing to get you an appointment, or are you going to have to wait?
Well, I hope so. Professor Wright led the proposal that we submitted to the Green Bank Telescope, and I think we'll probably hear the results of that in about 6 weeks. I understand that it has been received sort of relatively favorably, informally, from the observatory, but we hope that they will award us observations there and perhaps on some of the other telescopes that we talked about as well. But our scientific colleagues have to look at our work and what our ideas are and judge the merits of those, as you said, against the many other users of the telescope.
So, Jason Wright, back to you, our professor at Penn State University. You think then that the chances are pretty good that the research will be possible before very long?
Well, I hope so. We'll certainly try to convince our colleagues that this is an interesting target, not necessarily just in terms of extraterrestrial life, but the fact that it's so hard to explain the light curve that we see from this star. I think that means it'll be pretty easy to follow it up, at least from a natural science perspective, to try and solve this mystery of what's making it behave so oddly.
So maybe it's some sort of big solar device, as you suggested earlier, or maybe it's something else.
Maybe it's a giant cloud of exocomets after all. That would be amazing.
Okay. Well, thank you both for being with us. We'll certainly wait to be with great interest to see what conclusions you come up with. Jason Wright at Penn State, Andrew Simeon at the SETI Research Center, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence at UC Berkeley. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast at a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.